Thank you, John, and good morning all. First, let me congratulate John and Cindy for initiating this symposium. I'm not biased, but I think it's incredibly timely. And I think if the agricultural community doesn't recognise sulphur sooner rather than later, we're in real trouble. What they've asked me to do is to talk about this very difficult area of sulphur soil testing. And as Mike has just pointed out, Australian soils are often very deficient in sulphur, and this is an example from the New England Tablelands of New South Wales, a pasture site, always been under pasture, and you can see the massive responses to sulphur applied to sulphate. I've divided the talk into four sections. Firstly, what is the problem? Secondly, what causes the problem? Thirdly, how we've gone about addressing it, and lastly, a report card. What I've done is to look around the world at the correlations that exist between various soil tests and crop responses. And this is some data from Lewis Prochnow's work in Brazil that I was fortunate enough to be involved in. 21 soils collected from throughout the cropping areas of Brazil in a pot experiment. And this is a relationship between monocalcium phosphate sulphur, extracted sulphur, and crop response. And you can see it isn't all that good. I've been involved in some work with Shell across China evaluating sulphur fertilisers. And this is the results. The trials were conducted by the Sulphur Institute. And this is the relationship again between monocalcium phosphate extractable S and crop response. And again, not so good. TSI, the Sulphur Institute, have been very much involved for a long period of time in work in India. And this is the results from the proceedings of the Indian trials in 2003, where the Indians are using calcium chloride extractable sulphur. And you can see that I think if you included your grandmother's birthday in there, it would probably increase the utility of that test. Another group from some other field trials we've been involved in China, in the Jiangxi province, and this is with rice. And this is with monocalcium phosphate again, looking at on the y-axis, the percentage of maximum yield, and against the extractable sulphur. And again, I think you'll see that you wouldn't be very confident in using that to predict. This is in the same area, using upland crops rather than flooded rice. And again, you can see that it's not a very strong relationship. Field trials in Argentina, Ricardo Melgar and his co-workers at the University of Buenos Aires, the field trials that they've done using potassium phosphate as the extractant, and again you can see that the relationship is not all that good. They've gone one step further in looking to incorporate organic matter and CEC, incorporating that with the sulphur soil test to see if they can modify or improve the efficiency of that sulphur soil test. And you can see it hasn't made any difference. So the real problem is that although there are lots and lots of soil tests being done throughout the world, there is not very good relationships generally between the amount of sulphur that's extracted in that soil test and crop response. So let me look at what factors are contributing to the problem. And firstly, it's the sulphur cycle. And if you just look at that, you'll see there's components in there. With the sulphate, as Mike has pointed out, is the centrepiece with all the sulphur that's taken up by the crop coming from that single soil pool, being fed by organic S in much the same way as the nitrogen cycle. You can get reduction in rice soils to sulphide, which is a temporary loss pathway. If you go to the left of the diagram, you see adsorbed sulphur. Mike talked about the adsorption capacity, the positive charges in the subsoils, and the adsorbed sulphur is similar in some ways to the absorption of phosphate. Are these all feeding in, and the factors that are determining the turnover rates of these is what makes soil testing for sulphur difficult. You're trying to determine, A, what's in the soil sulphur pool, and secondly, what's likely to enter that pool during the life of that crop. And if you put that in quantitative terms, my colleague Ray Till has done a lot of work over 40, 50 years on sulphur cycling, predominantly using sulphur 35 to trace this through the system. And this is a pasture system being grazed by sheep. And the size of the boxes represent the amount of that's in that pool. So the total soil pool there is of the order of 200 to 300 kilograms of sulphur per hectare. And what you're attempting to do, as I said in getting that sulphur soil test, is to be able to determine A, the size of the yellow pool, the sulphur, the soil available pool, and secondly, the contributions that are going to come into that pool, particularly from the blue, the very slowly cycling sulphur pool, that are going to feed into that to provide sulphur to that crop throughout the year. In a pasture system, it's even more difficult because you've got sulphur that's recycling from the animal pool and the dung and sulphur litter pool. It's going to feed into that system throughout the year. So really, what we're after is something that's going to give us a measure of what's in that sulphur pool and what's likely to enter that pool through the life of the crop or the pasture. Mike touched on the question of leaching, and we have a pretty good set of data from the National Reactive Phosphate Rock Project across Australia. We looked at sulphur down the profile at, I think it was 27 sites across Australia, and we've got data, similar data from some areas in China. But this shows you the real nuts of the problem. These are four profiles we've just selected to show you the variability that occurs. The two on the left there, one from N7 is from New South Wales and S22 from South Australia. These are all in pastures. And you can see the very pronounced accumulation of extractable sulphate sulphur, on the surface soils. And so taking a 0 to 10 centimetre soil test in that area of pastures, which are predominantly rooting systems, are in that top 10 to 20 centimetres, you're likely to get a fairly good estimate of the available sulphur that's for that particular pasture. On the other hand, if you come to the ones on the right, a Q from Queensland, S again from South Australia, you see the inverted soil profile. We've got very large accumulations of KCl40 extractable sulphur down the profile. We also have data on monocalcium phosphate, which shows a similar, but the trend is not consistent. But you can see that, again, in those areas, if you've got a shallow-rooted crop or pasture, again, the surface soil sample will give you a fairly good indication of what's likely. However, in areas like Malanda, where tree crops are common, you can see that taking a 0 to 10 centimetre soil sample will give you the wrong answer for the right reason. So the soil profile and understanding the sulphur down the soil profile is critical to the interpretation of the tests. In the budget that Mike presented, had accessions of sulphur, atmospheric accessions. This can be very important in very many areas of the world and can really upset the interpretation of soil tests. This is a slice across eastern Australia, northern New South Wales, showing the amount of sulphur occurring in the rainfall. And you can see how quickly it drops off. Within half a kilometre of the sea, the atmospheric accessions have dropped from 40 kilos down to 5 or 6 kilos. Sulphur being heavy, drops out of the rainfall very quickly if wind speeds are low. But we had a grower, a dairy farmer there right on the coast that has a soil test. No matter what test you use, the soil tested extremely low. It was a high pH sand, and he put out strips of sulphur, got no response to sulphur, and was very upset about that. But he was receiving 40 kilograms of sulphur in rainfall a year, and every time it rained, he got a sulphur application, so no wonder the test didn't work. So it needs to be taken into account. We've looked at sulphur and rainfall in Malaysia, and this is some data. Down at the bottom is Singapore, Johor Bahru is the industrial area, Kuala Lumpur and Penang, all industrial areas, and you can see the sulphur accessions in the rainfall, whereas in the centre of Malaysia, the rainfall accessions are down to 5 kilograms per hectare. That used to grow rubber with a low sulphur requirement, is now moved to oil palm, which has a high sulphur requirement. So here again, the crop and the sulphur accessions in rainfall can very much mask what the soil will be supplying to that system. One of the most elegant pieces of work, I think, on sulphur is Feng Yizhao work from England. On the left shows the amount of sulphur received in rainfall in the UK from 1850. Those lucky devils have got that Broadwalk experiment. Have been able to trace that through to the 1970s, that great peak, and then the drop-off that's occurred in the sulphur accessions in rainfall. And luckily they had all the wheat samples from the Broadwalk experiment as well. And you can see the contribution, the relative contribution of atmospheric sulphur to wheat sulphur on the right. And you can see it increasing up to, so that in the 1970s they were receiving all the sulphur they needed from the rainfall. And that's dropped off as the atmosphere has been cleaned. I understand that the leaching losses there are about similar to the input losses, and so that in that sense, it's quite different to the system that I showed you in Australia. Using historical data is not very useful either. This is some data from Australia, shows you how rapidly the sulphur deficiency, the onset, can occur. This is stopping single super phosphate applications. You can see that after 4 years, even the first year after ceasing applications, 15% of the sites that had been receiving single super were deficient in sulphur, and that increased to 74% later on. Some years ago, we were working in Indonesia with Sesmamrol from Erie, and we found very large areas of sulphur deficiency in eastern Indonesia. The farmers immediately reacted by putting on ammonium sulphate, and FAO went in back 2 or 3 years later and found no areas of sulphur deficiency, and concluded that the work we had done was in error. So taking historical data is not the way to go. You've got to be on the spot when you're going to make the fertiliser decision. Well, with that background, we spent a fair bit of time trying to overcome these problems. And I need to take you through a little bit, just briefly, through the methodology. Because of that big mix of sulphur pools that you've got in the system, what we've done is to use radioactive sulphur 35 to determine where which sulphur is being supplied to plants and that which is being removed by the extractor. So what we do, we take the soils, we equilibrate them with sulphur 35, so the sulphur 35 gets mixed with all the native sulphur, not all, but most of the native sulphur within the soil. And we then grow plants, and we use that to determine which of those various soil pools the plant is using. The specific activity is the ratio of the radioactive to the non-radioactive sulphur that's in a pool. So we can look at a ratio in a pool, and then we can look at the ratio in the plant. If they're the same, that means that all the sulphur is coming from that particular soil pool. So we then use what we call the specific radioactive ratio. Sounds like an economist fiddling with figures. But we're looking at the ratio of the specific activity in the plant and the circuit radioactivity in the crop, in the soil extracted. And if they're the same, as I said, it's coming from that pool. So just keep that in mind, because that's the basis from what we've done. So this is some work we did where we looked at growing ryegrass so we could get continuous harvests over a 98-day period. And we've divided the system up into the various soil pools. We've firstly got the blue pool down the bottom here, which is carbon, which is bonded directly to sulphur, very slowly cycling. The next pool, the red one, is the hydriodic acid soluble pool, which is that which is a carbon-oxygen-sulphur bond, essentially. The yellow one is that which is extracted with monopotassium phosphate, which is a combination of sulphate in source solution and an adsorbed sulphur and a little bit of organic. And the top one is that which is in the green. So if you go through time, you see, as we go through from 14 to 98 days, the size of the carbon sulphur, this is the relative amount in the total system, the proportion of carbon bonded sulphur is increasing. The reason it's increasing, because the red one, the adsorbed pool, is decreasing. Then the yellow one, you'll see the monocalcium phosphate sulphur is also decreasing, and that in the plant is increasing. So it tells us quite clearly that the plant is getting its sulphur from the red and the yellow pool, and the carbon bonded sulphur as a proportion of the total is increasing. At the end of the 98-day period, we took the soils, removed the plants, removed all the sulphate from them by leaching. So in phase two, we had just essentially the two pools. We had the carbon bonded and the carbon oxygen bonded pools that were there. We grew plants for another 70 days, and again, you can see that the decrease in the size of the red pool, the adsorbed S pool, was quite substantial, and that was going both into the plant and into the sulphate pool. And again, the carbon bonded pool was the one that was increasing in terms of total portion. So it tells us quite clearly that if we don't get a handle on the available sulphate pool, at least some of the adsorbed sulphur pool, then and the organic pool, which has this ester sulfate, so carbon, oxygen, sulfur bonds, we're not going to get a chance of predicting what the crop is or the pasture is likely to receive. So what we took, and I'll tell you about the KCL40 test now, what it is, and then we'll go back and see how it performed. Essentially, you can see, if you're familiar with nitrogen soil testing, it's a similar pathway, much weaker KCL and low temperature. So we take 0.25 molar KCL and heat it at 40 degrees. We extract 3 grams of soil in 20 mils of extractant for 3 hours at 40 degrees without shaking. Key thing is that once you've got that sulfur in solution, it contains both sulfur and organic S, so it's important to measure the total S that's in that extract. And we do this by ICP, the simplest way, or if that's not available, we oxidise it with peroxide and then measure the sulfate by turbidimetrically. So you can see that we're extracting the material, and we must measure all the S that's in that extractant. So using the specific radioactivity data, we've got a range of extractants. We use sodium bicarbonate because that's a very common soil test in Australia. For phosphate, we thought it would be good if we could measure the sulfur in there, water, monocalcium phosphate. Then we looked at KCL at different temperatures, 100 degrees, 80 degrees and 40 degrees. And this is a specific radioactivity ratio. Remember, if it's 1, it means that the crop and the pasture is, or the plant is taking sulfur from those extracts. And you can see as you go down there, as the very low SRR with sodium bicarbonate, much better with water, and as you go through there, as the temperature of the KCL is decreasing, the SRR is increasing, and in both the flooded and non-flooded systems, it was the one that came out on top in terms of extracting the sulfur from the pools, that in this case it was rice, about grown under flooded and non-flooded conditions. Putting all of what we've got together, this is essentially what happens. The plants are taking up the sulfate pool, and by measuring the specific radioactivity in that pool, and by measuring the specific radioactivity in these 4 major pools, the carbon bonded, the ester sulfate pools, and the inorganic pools, which contain both adsorbed and sulfate sulfur, we're able to get pretty close to understanding which of the different pools the different soil extractants are removing. And you can see here that the monocalcium phosphate pool is, this is deposited sulfur, it may be precipitated, takes all of the adsorbed pool, soil solution takes all of the soil solution pool and takes a small amount of the ester sulfates. Monocalcium KCL at 40 takes less of the deposited, all of the adsorbed, and a little bit more of the sulfur in the labile pool. And as the temperature goes up, you take more of that labile pool, which tends to overestimate what the crop is likely to receive. Sodium bicarbonate is much more severe, and the total S takes the total system. So the soil tests that measure total S, in my view, are completely useless. There's no way that the plant can tap those pools that are being removed. If you look again, the source of sulfur removed by the different extracts on the left is by monocalcium phosphate and the right by KCL. And you can see this is the data that goes into the one I showed you earlier. The loss from the HIS pool is larger with the KCL40. It's removing a larger amount of that sulfur, which is going to be released from that pool into the sulfate pool during the crop growth. Mineralised sulphur, which is that which is coming from directly from the organic matter, is higher with the KCL40, and it measures more of the original pool. So we've got a lot of background as to understand the pools that were being sampled, and what how they relate to plant uptake. Let me see how it's performed. This was the original work we did with pastures over 18 sites. This is the relationship between percent maximum yield and extractable S. And you can see, if you go down there, the ask weeds are low with water, 0.47 with monocalcium phosphate. And again, as you decrease the temperature of the KCL, the relationship increases. At low temperature, 25 degrees, not as effective. and shaking for KCL for 16 hours. We were hoping to be able to do the 16-hour shake we use for phosphate is convenient. You put it on at 5 o'clock at night and you take it off at 9 o'clock in the morning. That's the science behind it. And we're hoping that the sulphur test would do the same. But it overestimates the amount of sulphur that's in there. And the sodium bicarbonate overestimates it's taking too much of that pools of sulphur that the plant never sees. So you can see that there is a quite large range in the relationship between the soil test and the plant response with those various extractants. These are from two different... we looked at what the variability of the sulphur being extracted in the pasture was throughout the year. From two soils, the Crassenzem and the Podsolic on the northern tablelands of New South Wales, you can see that the mean amount of sulphur that's extracted by the various extractants varies quite markedly. These soils are 260 and 201 total S in the system. And with the KCL40, you see how much of a small portion of that total we're removing, as indeed with the MCP and the whether we measure the total phosphate in the MCP or just the inorganic. But the coefficient of variation, the variation that's occurring throughout the year, is much less with the KCL40 than it is with the other tests, because it's taking account of this sulphur which is being released from these other pools throughout time. We had the first calibration with 18 soils, and that was increased to 30. And on the left is the KCL40 test, and on the right is the MCP. And the solid line is the original calibration, and the dotted line is the verification, including all the tests. And you can see there's hardly any shift in the relationship that through time on the left, but a significant shift on the right with one of calcium phosphate. Looking at the predictability, this is looking at with the KCL40 test and the MCP test, looking at the correct predictions in a pasture on non-significant responses on the left and significant responses on the right. And you can see again that the KCL40 test is doing a better job at predicting both the non-responsive and the responsive sites through time. So let me conclude. As I indicated, that the sulphur cycle resembles both N and S, with has some similarities with P. Understanding the pools, I think, is critical. We found that to be the biggest learning experience, and why we believe that the KCL40 test has been able to perform better under at least our conditions and the conditions that I've used it in China. It's improved the predictability. And I recommend that you evaluate it in your own environment. And to that end, I'm very fortunate that both Cindy and John have provided me with some soil samples from their experiments in Canada and here. I've collected some samples around Texas, and I hope that the Grains Research Council in Australia is going to fund some more work on sulphur soil testing, particularly taking this question of sulphur depth. We're moving more and more into deep nitrate soil testing, so the opportunity is there to include sulphur soil tests down the profile. I'm not sure we need to go to that extent, because with characterisation, when I look through the data we already have from across the 27 soil profiles across Australia, we have a pretty good handle on the soil profile and the relationship, the amount of sulphur that's there, based on the pH of the depth and the organic matter. And so I'll go back now and look in much more detail. But I think that if you understand a lot more about the soil profile, get a soil test which takes into account the pools which are likely to be taken up by the crop, your chances are much better, and getting relationships are vastly improved from those which I showed you at the outset. Thank you.
Oh, we have a few minutes for questions before the break, so yes, please.
It's desorbing. Oh, Norman, good to see you. Norman asked the question: Is KCL a neutral salt? What's the chemistry of it extracting organic S? The carbon bonded sulphur is adsorbed to the clay complex, and so what it's doing is essentially desorbing. that sulfur. Thank you. The question is, do we heat it continuously throughout the time? It is continuously heated for 3 hours. In an oven. In an oven, yeah.
What is the depth of the soil?
Commonly in Australia, 0 to 10 centimetres, and all that data was taken on 0 to 10. Same as the other nutrients, yeah. I think, you know, one of the things, if you've got to take a separate sample for a particular test, you're in real trouble. And so that's why, as we move into cropping areas, looking at more and more deep nitrate, the opportunity of using those nitrate soil samples to measure sulfate concurrently is the way to go. We now use ICP exclusively, but that doesn't make any difference. If you do the turbidimetric sample measurement correctly using a suspending agent, it's just as good as ICP, provided you're only after the sulfate component that's in that. And sorry? But that's important because, as I said, it's what both the sulfate and the organic components that are in the extract that you need to measure. Because those organic components that are in the extract are the ones which are likely to become or going to become available to sulfate through time.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.